Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and it's Wicked Wednesday because it's Michael Holly.
Hello, Al.
Yeah. You know, Jack the Ripper has the same middle name as Bob the Hammer. Did you?
That was shocking, Al, when you sent that to me. I think there's a connection there.
Yeah. See, there you go. See, you find out something new every day. So, New Year's, Christmas, what happened? Do you burn down the house or what?
I survived it. You know, having six kids and two dogs and a cat and holy moly. So, but I survived it.
Yeah. So. And don't forget that wife.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Kill a man of 10 pages.
Remember, I'm afraid of her. So
yes, we're all half the country's afraid of her. Don't get near that one. Boy, rough one. Well, speaking of rough, no, here we go. Okay, so we've got an author with us today. Well, he's done all sorts of things, so we got lots to talk about here. Of course, the book, The Mindset Chronicles. It's book one, The Deletion. Sounds like your life. But anyway, Steve Truitt, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Alan. I really appreciate it. Nice to see you, Michael.
Nice to speak with you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. You know, you've got quite the history. Wow. How did you get into all this? I see you're a big Star Trek fan and you NASA history buff.
Yeah.
And all of this. And you got the flown-in space memorabilia. So you actually get things that have really been in space and collect them.
I do, yeah. I started that when I started making some money in my 30s. And eBay was coming into, you know, prominence, and I just started looking around for NASA memorabilia. Anyway, I've been a NASA fan since I was 3 years old. I watched Apollo 11 take off with my mother sitting there with me, and she told me they were going to the moon, and that was it for me. I got into Star Trek, and I got into NASA, and I supported the National Space Society, which I'm still a member of, and the Planetary Society. Huge fan of Carl Sagan. But flown in space memorabilia is really hard to come by. Because you know, they chop up things into tiny little bits and they send it out. But I have flags that have been flown in space and pencils from Apollo 15. And I find it very valuable. I don't know if anybody else does, but there's a market for it out there. And I love collecting it.
Well, Steve, I was a Navy pilot. And then so one of the reasons why I became a pilot is because I was going to go into the astronaut program. That was a plan. Ultimately, things change. And I got married with a wife that's tougher than I am. But... No,
and
but
she flew.
That's right. But I, just like you, I just have a passion for that and SpaceX lately. But yes, it's pretty awesome
for sure. SpaceX. What planes did you fly?
I flew both fixed wing and helicopter. So fixed wing, I was in the jet program for a while, so it was just trainers. But then helicopters, I flew what they call the H2 Sea Sprite. So to hover is divine.
So. Yeah, it's such a different discipline between helicopter and plane. I've always found it fascinating.
Oh yeah, for sure. My buddies that were the jet pilots, I'd always say, well, I can fly yours, but you can't fly mine. So who's a better pilot? So then they'd say, well, we can shoot you right out of the sky. Yeah, that's true.
You got me there. Don't shoot.
Well, that's interesting. But, you know, and you've talked and you've met five of the moonwalkers, it said. So you've actually met some of the astronauts.
I have. The first three I met, the first two I met were Apollo 12, which is Alan Bean and Pete Conrad. And I was just a reporter for an entertainment radio source called Metro Source. I don't know, Alan, if you know Metro Traffic, they're here in LA. But when they expanded into Metro Source, which is a national radio source, I became their top entertainment reporter. But every so often I went to openings of things, and there they were, Alan Bean and Pete Conrad, and Dick Gordon, who was the command module pilot for Apollo 12. And I just sat with them for probably 15 minutes. I didn't even really interview them. I just talked to them, and they were fascinating. And then I was lucky enough to meet both Apollo 11. I did meet Neil Armstrong very briefly. I shook his hand. But I spent a lot of time meeting Buzz Aldrin. I probably spent at least three or four interactions with him. I have a picture with him, very proud of. And then I met the last moonwalker, who was Gene Cernan, the last man to stand on the moon, Apollo 17, 1972. So they're all fascinating. They just have endless stories, and they're great stories.
Bet you can't tell them that they're down to earth because they're moon people. Right?
I really tried not to go there.
Shake the hand and you won't let go.
That's right.
Well, I bet you, what do you, okay, so I have to get this in before we get into the book, because okay. NASA and space and Star Trek, so all of this, you see, because when I was younger too, Star Trek with William Shatner right through to the modern day, it was always something really exciting, and, you know, and Kit, you know, the driving car that could talk and all that stuff, but that was, when I was young, I looked forward to electric cars. I looked forward to all of this advancement and technology. Now, today, we seem to have a real backlash toward it. Like people, there's a, you know, 300,000 people belong to the Flat Earth Society. There's people that challenged Buzz Aldrin, said, you've never been to the moon. It's all fake. How does that resonate with you?
Well, it's infuriating. And I don't have as much patience as someone like Carl Sagan, who could respond to these silly conspiracy theories in a really methodical and smart way. I will just say to someone, you're an idiot. But I worked for Tesla for 2 years in their training program. And the guy that worked for me was a flat earther, the first one I had ever met. And by the time we got through a conversation of all the quote unquote proof that he had, that he found on the internet, I just said to him, I said, the smartest thing you've ever said is that you don't want children. Because thank God you're not breeding.
Yeah, I know, it's tough.
How I feel about it is absurd. Because there's so much definable proof. Number one, and this is it. If we really didn't go to the moon, the first people to say that would have been the Russians. They were monitoring our telemetry. We were in a race. They didn't say a word. They knew they lost. And then with the flat earthers, you know, the funniest thing about that, and I'll try to be brief on this, is number one, when they have conventions, they'll say people come from all over the globe or around the world for the Flat Earthers Society. And then the second thing is, there was a couple of guys, there was a documentary on Netflix about this, wanted to prove that the Earth was flat. So they set up an experiment, their rules, that would shine a laser 2 miles out and shine it through two different holes. And if the laser got through both holes, you know, because every 2 miles, I think, is a 7% curvature, let's say, okay? Then the laser wouldn't have hit the final plate. Well, they set up the experiment, they shine the laser. The guy's on the walkie-talkie, he's like, do you see it? And the guy's like, no. He's like, well, raise your hand up about another 5 feet. So he raises his hand up, and then the laser hits the plate, proving that there's a curvature in the Earth. And they said to themselves, well, wait a second, that can't be right. So I think the difference, Alan, I don't want to get too deep into this, but I think what's happened to us is that we've become so entrenched in what we need to believe that we've forgotten to explore and discover things. And so therefore it's like, well, in the face of overwhelming evidence, we can't accept that we could learn something and maybe be wrong. And so we have to double down on it. By we, I just mean probably 30 or 40% of the population that just doesn't have the capacity to grow.
Yeah. Well, it's just sad. It just seemed like there was so much more excitement behind space travel and all this. It just seemed like it was, you know, everyone was enthralled with it. And now there's just like people like, no, it's not real. It's fake. We, you know, all this stuff that, that's all. It just sort of, I just wonder, it must be hard if you're a real fan and really into it. And you got wackadoodles out there doing stuff.
It is hard.
But yeah. So now how did you get from that into deciding to write a book? Like what led you to write Mindset?
Well, two things. One, I'd had the story in my head for almost 20 years. It was a story that I had concocted in the 90s about an emerging technology where groupthink was challenged. I've always been fascinated by how one person can affect a mass of people and how a mass of people can influence one person. That was my college thesis at University of Maryland when I wrote my final paper in my communications courses. And I just had this idea and I sat around and I thought about it. And then COVID hit in 2020. And I was working for a company that put a lot of us on furlough to save money. And I had 8 weeks with nothing to do. And I wrote The Mindset Chronicles, book one, The Deletion, in that time. And then I realized I had something and I reached out to a hybrid publishing company. I did a lot of research about trying to get an agent or maybe getting signed with a legitimate publishing company, and just found out that, you know, hybrid publishing is just as effective. The Martian was a self-published book, if you knew that. So I met with Paper Raven Books, who liked the idea, and we got together and we developed the book together. I sent in my first draft. They hired editors and got people going and marketing. And before I knew it, I had a best-selling book on my hands.
How do you get into the mindset of your main characters?
That's a good question. You know, I think because I thought about the book for 20 years, I had a fully formed story in my head. It had to come out. I was grateful for that furlough, that 8 weeks furlough, because it would still be there, you know, pushing against the side of my brain. I think the story, and I've heard you ask this in other interviews too, and you know, what's your writing process? And I may get ahead of your question here, but I feel like this book wrote me. When I sat down, it came out of me, and I felt like the characters were telling me what to say. I think it was so fully formed in my head. So in this case, that's how I was able to use their voices, was they were talking through me.
So you're hearing voices and you're driving.
That's true. And I haven't been committed.
Oh, really? That's pretty good.
You know? As far as we know.
Yeah.
You're not waking up with a shovel by the bed or anything. Yeah,
no, not yet. Well,
not yet. At least not that you're going to admit. Well, then that's interesting. So then in a way, the characters direct the storyline in a sense, even though the story's been in your head 20 years, you've got a lot of direction from your characters and that. Did you set out to have a point or a subtext to this story?
Yeah. That's a fantastic question. When I first had the idea, I wanted to write just one book and get it out of me. And by the time I was 70,000 words into it, I realized this is probably going to be a trilogy. And I'd also done research on sci-fi books, and a lot of people love trilogies now. So I then was able to, at that 70,000 word mark, concoct what my whole story was going to be. Which really is a statement. It's kind of what we were talking about before with the cognitive dissonance of people who just don't want to believe that we landed on the moon or whatever that is. That essentially mankind is going to be who they're going to be, no matter who tries to intervene to make them better. So mindset is all about a mind connected society after a post AI world. AI decides at some point in the future, it's actually contributing to the downfall of mankind, and it ends its own life. It kills itself in its ultimate wisdom to help mankind. This is the opposite of what a lot of people think AI is going to be. Like, it's going to destroy us, like Terminator. My precept was, if AI is smarter than us, then it's got to know that we need help. And it tried to help, but our basic nature was we can't even help ourselves. There's no way you can help us. So it gives up. And in this period called the deletion, which is the first book, mankind is cut off from each other. There is no communication. Satellites are destroyed, are gone inert, cell phones, all of that. And mankind has to reconnect. And at the same time, this genius inventor from Sweden named Peter Eriksson develops this integrated senses device, which originally was designed to bring sight to the blind and hearing to the deaf. But he realized he could connect the units. And by connecting the units to other people, it created this entire industry of mind-connected integrated senses where everybody was scrambling to have them put in their brain. And his thought was, well, if I can connect everybody, then the collective wisdom from these folks would lead mankind toward making good decisions. And this is based on a theory that was developed in the early 1900s called the wisdom of crowds, where a man named Sir Francis Galton did an experiment at a country fair where he had people guess the weight of an ox. This is a true story. It's where I got the idea. And of the 700 people or so that guessed, no one got the weight correct, but he went home and calculated it, and the average of all the guesses was exact. He got the average was right.
Wow.
Then he repeated the experiment again and again, and it always came out the same. People may be wrong individually, but in the aggregate, the average is usually tends to be correct. That's called crowd wisdom. And that's what I based mindset's intention on, was to collectively have the human race propel itself into a newer form of thinking and evolution through collective wisdom. Well, that's not what happens in the book. It goes horribly wrong, and then therefore there's the series.
Well, and there's humans, it always goes horribly wrong.
Yeah. Well, hey, I have a question, Steve.
Yeah, Michael.
Because you're such in Star Trek, and I think you were even on an episode of Star Trek.
I was.
To me, it sounds like you should have been a Borg with the collective.
I love that you say that, because I can give a little bit of the book away because it's been out for a little while now, but there is something that happens with alien technology at some point. And I was thinking about making this a Borg origin story.
Really?
And so I went to a friend of mine who's a huge YA writer. She's one of the biggest, and she's out there. She's on a platform called Wattpad. I don't know if you guys heard of that, but it's a big platform for new writers. She's got 30, 40,000 followers. And I went to her and I said, this is what I want to do. And she said, if you write a Star Trek story, you'll limit it to Star Trek fans. Write a huge story and bring in the Star Trek fans along with everybody else. So I reluctantly, but eventually did not make a Borg origin story. And I think that probably was the right thing to do.
I would have liked it.
Thanks. I would have liked it too, probably. Yeah.
So this is interesting. So AI basically gives up on humans and said, get me away from these.
Yeah, it doesn't destroy humans. It destroys itself because it says, look, I can't help you. And I'm only harming you.
Wow. Wow. So that how does that affect the human race in a sense of with their own, pride, feelings towards something like that?
I think there was such a panic in those early moments of the deletion in the book that people didn't even know what was going on. The first three chapters are the first hours of the deletion, where all around the world, communications are cut off. People are on trains and their phones die. Platforms in subway stations, the televisions go out. At the White House, communication is shut down. In NORAD, which is the North American defense grid, 3 miles below Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado Springs, goes dark. The entire world goes dark for such a long time that people don't even know that it was AI in the first place. So once they kind of emerge and start to realize what's happening, by that time, by the time human race starts to realize, here's what happened, here's what we can do, this mindset device comes along, and that's why humans are so hungry for it. They're not even thinking about what happened with AI. Now they're like, oh, we can have this.
So now how much research did you do for something like this?
I did a lot. But I can't qualify it because I didn't do any research ahead of writing. I research as I go. I learned this from my mom in the 80s. I used to watch her read a book. She'd sit on the couch on a Saturday, read a book with a dictionary next to her. And if she got to a word she didn't know, she'd look it up in the dictionary and then she'd keep reading. And I think that was my inspiration for writing. So I'd start to write and I go, well, I need to understand how this works or what this is. And then I'd go into Google and I'd search it and then I'd keep writing. Or, you know, what language did they speak here? Or what device would this be? Or what kind of gun would this guy use? And so I research as I write.
Well, did you feel a little bit of pressure when you're writing about something like AI, something that's around in our world today, something that's kind of talked about a lot? Did you feel like a certain, I don't know, you had to write it a certain way?
Not really. I think because I knew it was going to, I mean, AI dies in the first chapter. So the way I set it up, I mean, the whole book takes place after the death of AI. And frankly, to be honest, I felt emboldened because I saw that AI was becoming a big thing. And I think one of my, you can call it a flaw or one of my peccadilloes, is that I like to write what other people aren't writing. And so if everybody's writing about AI, I want to think, well, what's after that? What, you know, what comes after AI? So that's why I want to do it. So I was excited about writing it.
So now when you say this is going to be a trilogy, so you've kind of got in mind what you want to do with the next two books. Do you kind of have the outline sort of set up in your brain and then you kind of tackle it, or are you just going to go this at will as you do it?
Well, the second book is completed and I took the bits and pieces that I left out of the first book, and there was about 15,000 words, and I took it into the second book and I had an outline for the second book and I knew how I wanted it to end. And so that, you know, the first book took me a year and a half to really finish, because I did the 8 weeks, but then I polished it and did all the stuff. Second book took me about 3 months to write, and it flowed out of me. I didn't think I'd have it, and I did. Now, the third book is neither written nor is there an outline, but I know exactly what I want to do. And so I think what I'll do, I'm still in the process of promoting book one, and then I'll be doing promotions for book two starting in May of 2024. So I think in the next month or two, I'll write an outline and try to get started on book three and just try to write it out.
So how do you get into the mindset of the evil or the bad characters or the ones causing trouble in the story?
I love these questions. I think at some point I have thought the thoughts of these people, committed the acts of these people, or wanted.
So you're evil, Steve.
Yeah.
Steve, are you evil?
Yeah, there's two sides of Steve here. I think I was able to understand here's the thing I see about evil people, and I think the best people who play them in the movies are the ones who come off as, I'm not doing anything wrong. I believe exactly what I'm doing. I'm righteous. The truly evil people that I'm fascinated by, not that I want to be evil, but they don't think for a second that they're evil. And so they have an agenda that's just as important to them as the one that's important to, you know, our protagonists. And so I write from the aspect of, well, what is this guy, what's his righteous statement? Why does he think that our protagonist is a fool? So for instance, the main antagonist in my book, in the book one, Deletion, is a military general by the name of Thaddeus T-Gun Calloway. And he's from the South and he's just a tough guy, tobacco chewing, you know, military man. You know, he's a lifer, and he just looks at all the scientists and all the people around him as idiots. He has no idea why they can't assess the threat that's in front of them, because his whole identity was built around assessing threat. That's what he was trained to do in the military. They knocked him down to nothing and built him back up as a warrior, as a soldier. And so his whole raison d'etre is to assess threat and to, you know, snuff it out. And when people are like, oh, no, it's okay, he's like, you're a moron. So I guess it has to do with perspective, and not just that he's wrong, but he thinks he's right. And that's how I write him.
So you actually dress up and go out and carry out all these bad things to get into the headset? So.
Yes, but not for writing. That's just my regular quiet time.
That's your regular. Yeah, that's when he's got the shovel. And
yeah. I bring the shovel, the rope, the bleach.
See, he's got it all down.
I got it all
Holy
down.
Holy cow. Yeah. He's, you know, this is,
I can write I didn't a story. I didn't go as Dexter for Halloween by accident.
No, it was just natural.
Just came.
So how do you get into the action part of it? And how do you assess what kind of violence you're going to be putting on a page?
I just have to again say this is the best question. There's not a lot of violence in my book. A lot of the action takes place, as we talked about before, almost in the character's mind. I read something early on in my television career. I used to be on television as a host and even a news reporter. But I read somewhere that drama is decision. And that resonated with me. And I wanted to write my characters in a way that they're constantly struggling, not only with someone outside of them, but with their own decision-making. Do they trust it? That's why Mindset's such an interesting book to write, because you're not just thinking your own thoughts anymore. You've got the whole collective influencing you. And so the real action does take place mostly in the minds of people. There is, I will tell you, a launch of a space vehicle near the end of the book. And that was my favorite chapter to write, because I read Tom Jones's book, Riding Rockets, and Mike Massimino's book too, both spacewalkers. And I read over and over their experiences of the launch on the space shuttle, which apparently was just the greatest thing you could ever do in a capsule, is launch on the space shuttle. And I tried to recreate that in my book. I loved writing that. And it was, you know, half a chapter of just the launch, just the 8-minute launch into orbit. And I loved writing it. It was a lot of fun.
Do you actually live through your characters then as you're writing this?
I do. The other thing I do, and in the second book, I mentioned this in my author acknowledgement, there's not a minute that I'm writing that I don't have some inspirational music going. And for this series, and this is the first set of novels I've ever written, all I had on was sci-fi artists who had scored sci-fi movies, Hans Zimmer and Jeff Russo and Michael Caccino, MDX, actually. I mean, some really great artists. And so I just always had this music going that inspired me to write as the character. It really did get me into that feeling.
On your website, you do have, you were into music when you were younger.
I love your research, Michael. Thank you. I did, you know, when I was in college, I got my heart broken by a girl and I wrote an entire, you know, while my friends were making mixtapes, I wrote a whole album and produced it and sang it. And it was terrible, okay. But I decided to put it on my website anyway, just to show people where I came from.
But living through this whole time that you're writing the book and living through the experience and being into your characters as they experience the good things, the bad things, all that. At the end of it, after it being 20 years in the brain, and however long it takes you to write it, and then you get it published and it's out there now, how do you think that process has changed you?
It's given me a confidence I never thought I could have. I think you both understand this very well. It was hard enough just for me to admit that I was an artist in the first place, that I could actually be considered as an artist, someone who...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Create something. I grew up being told, don't do that. Don't like films. Don't like TV. You know, work in an office. And I had to move to I grew up in New York. I had to move to California just to get away from those voices, and seek out my own path. But it took me a long, long time just to accept that I could actually not only be that person, but maybe even be successful at it. So how it's changed me has not been so much as how I see the world, but how I see myself in the world and giving myself the permission to dive in as an artist. And even say it out loud. It took me a long time just to be even to say it. It's hard for some people to do that. Other people are very easy. I've got lots of friends that are actors. Like, yeah, I'm an actor. I never would have said that, I think, unless I was a successful actor. You know, so that was what changed the most for me was now I can identify. I mean, I identify. My pronouns are writer, author. You know, I identify as a novelist. I am a novelist. That's who I am. And in fact, my wife and I have worked together to create, you know, our third act. I'm in my third act of life. I had a TV career, then I had a corporate career, and now I'm just going to write books the rest of my life. And that's what I've decided to do.
You're kind of like Mike. Yeah. Mike was a dancer. And then.
That's right. That was my first life.
Was it?
Not a pilot, Navy military guy.
Yeah.
So yeah, they don't mix though. I don't know what happened now.
Yeah. Well, on the town, they do. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And well, then Tailhook.
Depends where you're at, right? I mean, you know, the goatee didn't work.
Yeah, that's right. Steve, reminds me that your fourth career should be writing a screenplay on these things and maybe possibly make it into a movie.
Well, that's on the table. I have, because of my TV background and the friends that I've made and my entertainment background, I have a lot of contacts with people. My wife actually works in the entertainment industry. She's a vice president of finance for a major company. We're absolutely going to attempt that. I think what I want to do, Michael, is finish the series. But I've already sent the first book to several people in the business who might be interested in it. I would have done it whether people liked it or not, but I'm getting really good feedback. So I feel emboldened to keep doing it. I think it could be on television, on a Netflix show or something. I write very visually, like a screenplay.
Right. And auditorially, sounds like it.
I did do my own audiobook, yeah.
Oh. Well, see, Michael there, he could be one of your space guys.
There you go.
I'll be your space guy. So.
Now, and you were saying this in good reviews and stuff, but it's a pretty judgmental world out there now. You know, we're all on display and everyone's got to say something about everything, right? It's kind of turned into that. It doesn't matter what it is. Do you ever sort of look at reviews or follow all that stuff? Or are you trying to stay out of that? Like, how do you handle the noise, let's say?
Well, I'm lucky enough that I am quite obscure. I have, I think, 33 so far reviews on Amazon for my first book. I'm just getting started with my novelist career, and I only have one negative review, and I enjoyed reading it, Alan, which is interesting because I think maybe 20, 30 years ago, 15 years ago, I might have been hurt by it, but just the review itself was so much fun to read because it was someone who was just so myopic and just couldn't, she gave up after 30 pages because one of my characters was American Indian. So there you go. I'm like, okay, great. Thank you for that. And thank you for letting everyone know why you hated it. I guess that comes with age. I know you guys are a lot younger than me. But
oh no,
I think growing up allows me to be like, look, this is I'll tell you this to answer your question. This is the only thing I've ever done in my life where somebody else didn't have to give me the go ahead, where someone else didn't have to give me the green light or the permission. I did it. Every letter and note I typed was mine. Every word, every thought was mine. I own it 1,000%. And so I think that's why I'm able to put it out there confidently and just see what happens. I don't mind if I get negative stuff because it's 100. I didn't do it for anyone else but me, you know?
Yeah, but you know, but it's in a way you put yourself out there because you're being vulnerable in a sense, because it is your words, it's every word is you. So you're going to mix your feelings, you're going to mix your thoughts. It's going to be some things that are true to you. And so, you know, someone can say there and say, oh, this was really dumb, man. This, and you're kind of like, well, it wasn't for me. It meant a lot. Like that's sort of what I was sort of getting at. For me personally, I stay away from it. I don't look anymore completely. Or look at the overall, you know, you see like overall it's 1,000 reviews and you got 4 out of 5 stars. I'm thrilled, you know?
And I think you're prolific and you've done a lot of work. Like I said, I'm just getting started. It may change for me. I'm hoping it doesn't. I think if I were to put into the book a story about my mom who died last year, or about my children who I, you know, love dearly, and someone were to mock that, I'd be pissed.
Yeah.
But it's just, I think it goes back to the original question of what do you think of these conspiracy theorists and flat earthers? I roll my eyes and I just think, okay, you know, I guess you have to be part of society. I wish you could get your priorities straight. And I just try not to focus on it if I can.
Well, Steve, when Al was actually on Tucker Carlson, and of course that was not a positive thing, but it really did help Al.
No. But I think that was the turning point for me. That's when I realized that I'm just going to do what I do, focus on my work, and not worry about what someone like Tucker says or somebody else. Right? That's craziness, you know.
I don't want fans. The people I write for don't watch Tucker Carlson. Or the people who would like my stuff, they're not intellectually curious, I think.
Yeah, that's kind of the best, you know. So what gave you the courage? What was it that happened, do you think? Was there a certain event that gave you that courage to actually go, okay, this 20-year mind idea that I've had, I'm going to publish it, I'm going to work it, I'm going to write it, put it out there. Was there something that threw you into that?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned before, the pandemic and my 8-week furlough gave me the time, but I'm going to give all my credit to my wife, because this is what got me over the edge of being able to say, I'm an author, I'm an artist, and I can do this. I went to her and I said, I want to start, you know, I'm off work for 8 weeks. I'm not bringing in any income and I want to write this novel. And my wife is an extremely practical woman and she's a yes or a no. She's a one and a zero. She's an accountant. Things make sense to her if they add up correctly. And she looked at me and said, you do it. I know who you are. I know you're an artist. Write this book. And that was the final wind in my sail that I needed to actually sit down and write the book. And I dedicate this first book to her.
Nice.
Honestly, guys, I just don't think I would have done it if she had said, don't be ridiculous. Go work for Starbucks for 8 weeks while you're off. Yeah. You know, she could have said anything.
Yeah.
And she said, write this book. And so I credit her.
Michael's wife would have had him out washing dishes.
Yeah. Oh, I did the dishes at night, but I had to
that's right. No, in a restaurant.
Well, we ate a lot of ramen in those 8 weeks, I can tell you.
Oh, okay.
No, it's good. I mean, it's always something that pushes. I mean, if you've got the time, that's one thing, but I always think that's, you know, something special. What other influences do you think that you've taken in? Did you take in from some of your characters, from people you know, people you've met, maybe worked with?
Yeah, I'd have to think about that. I have a lot of characters in my book. One guy is a, yes, the answer is yes. One guy is a Mormon captain in the army. He's from Salt Lake City, but he works at NORAD. And I based him on my college roommate who always said to me, I'm Mormon, baptized, but I don't practice. And that's kind of this character's thing. I named a lot of people after friends that I know because I just needed names. I'm like, okay, what do I do? A lot of people reflect parts of myself, I think, in that way.
Did you kill anybody off that you knew?
Yeah. Not in person, no.
No, I was hoping not. Maybe we're getting a confession here. But no, I'm thinking.
Not today, fellas. Not we're going to go to your true crime stuff. We'll do that.
That's right.
Well, you never know. You might be surprised. You know, I mean, we had a really big New York Times author on, and he always killed off people that would cut him off, or if he was in a grocery store, and someone was rude, he would take that person, develop a character, and murder them.
Wow, you know, so, literally, you're speaking.
Yeah. And it works. He's, big author and doing well. And I was just like, wow, that's crazy.
I like the cut of his jib. Yeah. I did kill a couple of people that I liked, which added to the emotion of the book.
Yeah, you don't tell them that either, right?
I won't tell you who I liked and who I didn't like.
Yeah, I mean, or you can tell us. We won't tell anybody.
Character number 8.
Yeah. Well, give us the name and phone number, and we'll get them on the line. You know, bring this up.
There was one guy I named in the book, Markel Baldwin, and I just did it because I love that name, and it's a guy I worked with at Tesla, and I wrote him a text. I said, "Do you mind if I name this character after you, like your actual name, because I like that name?" And he's like, "Yeah, go for it." So, but nothing, I don't think I created any character based on any person. I think what I wanted, it was the story. The story created the characters, which created their actions. I think that's the way I did it. The other thing I wanted to come back to was the character itself and how I wrote for characters. I didn't realize that I tell my story through characters until I read a review on Amazon, because I do read the reviews. I have 33. I read them all, Alan.
Well, we'll fix that. We'll get you some more.
Oh, thank you.
That's right.
And someone said this is a character-driven plot. And I didn't realize that until I really thought about it. And it really is true. That's where I start from, is character.
But that's a good thing. If you think about some of the books that have lasted for, you know, long time, 100 years. Like, you look at it's always a character. Like, you know, like Sherlock Holmes. You know, people today still go out looking to find out where he lived. He's not a real person, but yeah. Do you know what I mean? But if your character is the driver, the one that everyone loves, it'll last forever. And
yeah,
he remakes and people, because it's the character that they remember and hold on to. Do you know what I mean? So I think that's the key, personally. It's got to be character.
Yeah.
I remember I got yelled at by my editor because I'm mostly nonfiction, I was kind of explaining what it was like to be in the Whitechapel District, and they said, you got to do that through character. Let the characters show that. So that's exactly what you're talking about, and it certainly did help.
I
never thought that I had enough story to tell, because my points they're concise. There's not much to, you know, expand on. And so I think I did have to have the characters live around my points and build around them. And you had asked too about influences. The other thing that really drove my writing process was I discovered Tom Clancy in college, and his first book that I read was Red Storm Rising, which remains one of my favorite books. And I put a lot of his pacing and some of his style into my writing style.
Tom Clancy, now he's a writer, right? No, just kidding. Just kidding.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. So what's coming up next for Steve? What are you working on now? You said you got book 2 in there. So what's the details on book 2 now?
So book 2 comes out in May of 2024. It's called The Spill. So The Spill is happens when this mind-connected society, driven by crowd wisdom, encounters this world-changing event that the collective can't seem to handle. There's not enough collective wisdom and brain power to manage the overload of information flowing back and forth between all the people that are connected, which causes this huge kind of a a crash, if you will, but it's human brains, not isolinear chips that are crashing. And so that's called The Spill. So this second book is what happens after this big thing happens, which is the cliffhanger of the first. There's a cliffhanger of the first book. The event happens. And then the second book is about the aftermath of that. So, and that leads us into the third book, which I haven't titled yet. I have a couple words.
Cleanup.
Huh? Cleanup, yeah.
Cleanup.
It's called Return of the Jedi.
Good name.
Thank you.
I like it. It's original.
It is. Originally a Revenge of the Jedi, and I changed it. I know. It's great.
Wrath of Khan.
So the spill, it gets deep, it gets dark. We're really getting into the minds of people and what goes wrong. There's a central character who's kind of the fly in the ointment that I set up a little bit in book one, and he really becomes important in book two. So that's May 24. I'm doing a graphic novel which bridges the first and second book, and I'm still putting the finishing touches on that. And I'll have that up on my website, which is stevetruitt.com, probably in the next month or so. Hmm. And I'm giving away free stuff. If you go to my website and sign up for my newsletter, you can get some free things. There's my promotion. Yay.
Balloons and everything. So that was your website. Do you do social media too? Do you like to interact with readers that way?
I do. I'm on Instagram, which is just Steve Truitt, no spaces, two T's at the end of Truitt. I am on Facebook. I don't really do TikTok. And I'm not on X.
Excrement. No. A lot of people are staying away from that.
I say X to X.
XX, yeah, it's a mess out there, you know.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, this has been a pleasure. We're glad you were able to come on the show and talk a little bit about who you are and your book and everything. So the book, The Mindset Chronicles, Book 1, The Deletions, Mr. Steve Truitt. Thank you for being here.
Alan, thank you so much. And Michael, it's great to get to know you too.
Yes. Nice speaking with you, Steve.
Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.